welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Shabbat Parshat Pinchas, for the first time in 5 or 6 weeks. Everybody around the world, Jewish of course, who do read Torah, will read the same Parsha of Pinchas. We have just come back in sync from Shavuot time by Chutz Laretz reading reading Chukat and Balak last week, when we in Israel read just Balak. So Parshat Pinchas, which happens to begin the 3 weeks, and I would like to think it's not merely a coincidence, but it works out that when Chutz La'aretz Jews and Eretz Yisrael Jews are out of sync, at least in this token fashion of reading a different weekly portion, we get our act together, we unify a little bit, specifically as we enter the mournful period of Bein HaMetzarim, the 3 weeks, so that we could face this period of time and the challenges to our generation to maybe bring about the Geula a little bit faster. It's a challenge of every generation, but we have to address it as our own challenge, that at least we came together for Parshat Pinchas. I will share with you in a moment what I shared with a group of Torah Tidbits folders yesterday about the non-coincidence of Pinchas being the Parsha associated with Shivas Arba Tammuz in one way or another, and how it carries with it a message different but hopefully hopeful compared with the message of Shivas Arba Tammuz in the 3 weeks. We'll do that in a moment. First, let's say Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130, this time with the extra emotion caused by the fact that we have a particular crisis in Israel now, which is really all the Jewish people in the world, that of kidnapped soldiers, in addition to the one soldier kidnapped 2 weeks ago, two more were kidnapped yesterday, at the cost of 8 lives of soldiers. There's now military engagement both in the Gaza area as well as on the Lebanese border and into Lebanon. And we need to ask God's help in this situation. Shir ha-ma'alot mi-ma'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihiena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Imavonot tishmorya Adonai miya amod. Ki imecha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi v'lidvaro ho'cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi-shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. And I hope that listeners say this together with me, not just listen. So this way, technically, if you listen to a prayer over the phone, even if you say Amen, it's not really the equivalent of saying it on your own. You have to hear it personally. So that in lieu of that, let my saying it be like a prompt so that you could say it along with me, and then the prayer counts for everybody. Before we say Achenu, in which we petition God to help our brothers in trouble, let us focus in on the words once again, and then we'll say it, and then we'll possibly play it as well. Achenu, our brothers, Kol Beit Yisrael, all of the house of Israel, Hanatunim batzara, who are found in trouble, uvashivya, and in captivity. And as such, I want it this time to focus on the 3 captured soldiers, on Jonathan Pollard, in a different sense, who is a captive, and on any other Jewish captives around the world, as well as those Hanatunim, Batsara, that are in Tsaras, whether they be at sea or on land, may God have mercy on them, take them out of their trouble, from their darkness to light, from enslavement to redemption, speedily, now. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya, ha'umedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'meyafela la'ora, u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Today is Shivasar B'Tammuz, the fast of the 17th of Tammuz. It marks, according to the Mishnah, five tragedies that occurred. The breaking of the first set of tablets, when Moshe Rabbeinu saw Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. The Luchot were broken. He broke them. He smashed them. He dropped them, and they broke. Different commentaries explain it differently. But the fact of the matter is that the sin of the golden calf, a mere 40 days after revelation at Sinai, accompanied by the loss of that precious gift from God, of the down payment, so to speak, of the Torah, the two tablets of stone written by the hand of God. That's one of the calamities recorded for the 17th of Tammuz, the cessation of the Korban Tamid, the daily sacrifice, apparently occurred 3 weeks before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Until then, even during the siege, the people managed to be able to continue this constant reminder, constant function of the temple that on a daily basis connects the people of Israel with God. I say that with hesitation because there are plenty of things that connect us with God, but this was the constant, and it terminated on the 17th of Tammuz. Jerusalem was breached during the time of the Second Temple on the 17th of Tammuz. We are told that during the First Temple it was on the 9th of Tammuz, but rather than add an additional fast day to the calendar, our sages decided to consolidate the anniversary commemoration of the breach of Jerusalem only on the 17th, when there were other tragedies that were associated with that day as well, plus the fact that the second Beit HaMikdash was a physically more magnificent structure than the first and hits that chord in people more so, perhaps. I never really understood that idea. But certainly we can understand it in light of the fact that the first Beit HaMikdash was rebuilt. The first Beit HaMikdash was down for a 70-year period. The second Beit HaMikdash has not been rebuilt yet and is being mourned close to 2,000 years. So that if you had to choose, here are two dates too close to make fast days out of each of them. To which date shall we consolidate? They decided on the 17th of Tammuz, because the breach of Jerusalem was during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. There was also an idol that was erected in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, which made it, let's say, extra vulnerable to destruction. And a person named Apustamos burned a Sefer Torah on the 17th of Tammuz. It is definitely a day set aside for tragedy. Before we continue on any of that discussion, let's listen to a previously recorded, I might add, in front of a live audience. But here is that piece on the Parsha calendar connection.
But let me start with the fact that Pinchas is usually the first Shabbat of the 3 weeks. In other words, it's right after Shivasar B'Tammuz. There are rare years where it's right before Shivasar B'Tammuz. Shivasar B'Tammuz will be Sunday, and this Pinchas will be the Shabbat before. So it's either one or the other, and therefore it's unavoidable to associate Pinchas with Shivasar B'Tammuz specifically and the 3 weeks of mourning the Churban Beit HaMikdash in general. What makes it interesting, or maybe poignant, is that if you look into Pinchas, you see a few different, very encouraging things related to Eretz Yisrael and the Beit HaMikdash, exactly the things that we mourn with Shivasar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av in the 3 weeks. So you have, for example, the story of the daughters of Tzalafchad, who are credited with a love of Eretz Yisrael to the point where it wasn't enough for them to just live here. They wanted to own land, and their father was entitled to land, their grandfather was entitled to land, and because they had no brothers, they were afraid that they would not get the land. So the Torah teaches us the laws of inheritance in this context, and verily, however that goes, the daughters of Tzalafchad were to receive the portions due their father and their grandfather. Let me digress for a moment. The distribution of land in Eretz Yisrael was very complex. It was done by divine lottery, or divine assisted lottery, so it worked out. But the actual computation of how much each family got is complicated by the fact that it was the people who left Egypt, the male population from 20 to 60, who were given the land, yet none of them survived except for Kalev and Yehoshua. So it is their heirs who get to the land that was due them. In other words, the census that is taken in Parshat Pinchas are the people who will actually get the land, but not the people to whom the land is being distributed. Now, what that translates to on a practical level, take as an example the daughters of Tzalafchad. Had the land been destined to be given to the generation that went into Eretz Yisrael, they would get nothing, because it would be the census of male from the age of 20 and up. However, it was the census of what's called Yotzei Mitzrayim, the ones who came out of Egypt, that is the population that received the land, even though almost none of them went in. So the daughters of Tzalafchad benefited from the laws of inheritance, because by the laws of inheritance, without brothers, they inherit whatever their father had. Now, their father never actually got it, because he came out of Egypt. He was above the age of 20. He was counted. He died out sometime in the course of the 40 years. So he never got it. But it was due him, and therefore it went to his daughters. Also, his father, Chefer, was also counted among those who came out of Egypt, and also died in the Midbar, never actually receiving the land, but it was due him as well. But because he wasn't alive, his inheritance goes to his sons, which included Tzalafchad, who isn't alive anymore, so it gets passed down to his daughters. So they ended up with more than the average share, because they had their father's entire allotment, plus two parts, since their father was a Bechor, two parts out of, I don't remember how many sons Chefer had, but however many they had, you add one, you divide it, and then the Bechor gets two, and that gets passed down to the daughters. So that's, you know, one of the complications of the laws of inheritance. In any event, the desire to live in Israel, to have land in Israel, was considered a stark contrast to the Meraglim. The Meraglim, who said, we have everything we need for a complete Torah life here in the Midbar. We have heavenly food in the form of man. We have divinely given water in the form of a miraculous well. We have clothes that grow on us. We have shoes that never wear out. We have climate control protection from the heavenly clouds of glory. We have Moshe Rabbeinu, the prime teacher of Torah ever. And therefore, we don't need, nor do we want, to go into Eretz Yisrael. That attitude is Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, which we associate mostly with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, had its black reputation already sealed with Chet HaMeraglim, because tradition says the Meraglim returned from their sojourn on the 9th of Av. That was the day they panicked the people into rejecting Eretz Yisrael. That was the day that God decreed that no one from that generation, except males, except Yehoshua and Kalev, would go into Eretz Yisrael. So, as we enter the 3 weeks that mourn the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and all of the other things, which include Chet HaEgel and Chet HaMeraglim, because Chet HaEgel is associated with Shivasar B'Tammuz, in addition to the breach of Jerusalem, and the sin of the spies is associated with Tisha B'Av, in addition to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, it's ironic, or poignant, or however you want to describe it, that we enter the 3 weeks of mourning with Parshat Pinchas, which has such an encouraging story of the daughters of Tzolofchad. Then you read further, and you get to the Korbanot, the daily sacrifices of the Beit HaMikdash, the Musaf of Shabbat, the Musaf of Rosh Chodesh, the Musafim of all of the holidays, which include a par, some of them, par or two parim, or more in the case of Sukkot. Specifically, the sacrifice, the communal sacrifice of a bull, is considered an atonement for Chet HaEgel, the sin of the calf. So that, again, as we enter that period which mourns the results of the sin of the calf, we read about the repair of that, namely the korbanot in the Beit HaMikdash that came from the cow family. Then you could generalize that to the fact that all of these korbanot are discussed, presented in Parshat Pinchas. They make up the maftir of every chag, every single chag, whatever special reading there is in the first Torah, the second Torah gets Parshat Pinchas to the Musaf of the day. Every Rosh Chodesh has the portion from Parshat Pinchas. So it happens to be the most read from Sedra of the whole Torah. If you add up how many Rosh Chodesh days you have in a year and how many Chagim with Maftir, you find Pinchas is read from more than any other Sefer, but any other Parsha. But that's not the point. The point is that the Parsha that leads us into the mourning, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, is very Beit HaMikdash oriented with all of these korbanot. So that's the story. That's at least my comment about the fact that Pinchas should not be seen as a coincidence of the calendar, which it is, but nothing is a coincidence. In general, you could look at every calendar date. Take a look at Parshat HaShavua. Take a look at several calendars to see that, oh, in this year it's this Parsha, but in other years it's this Parsha or whatever. And you could probably find something meaningful to connect the Parshat HaShavua that happens to be the week of Hanukkah, the Parsha de Shavua that happens to be right before Pesach, or right before Shavuot, or right after this, or Rosh Hashanah time, on Rosh Hashanah itself, we don't read Parsha de Shavua, because there is no straight connection. But it's always interesting to see, just to give you an example, the Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah, always the Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah, we read Nitzavim. Sometimes we read Nitzavim and Vayelech, sometimes just Nitzavim. But always the Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah is Nitzavim. Nitzavim contains, among other things, the command to do tshuva. Very appropriate for Rosh Hashanah. Nitzavim contains the concept of free will, which is the basis of Schar V'Onesh, reward and punishment, associated with Rosh Hashanah. And it is the basis of Tshuva also, because if a person is predestined to do something, he doesn't have to apologize for it, he doesn't have to atone for it, if that's how he was made. But if we believe in free will, which we do, then Rosh Hashanah has a lot of significance. And the Parsha that teaches us that we have free will is Parshat Nitzavim, which is always before Rosh Hashanah. Now, it could be, to be honest, that any Parsha that would be the one before Rosh Hashanah, we could find something to say about it. But it almost feels like a natural, like what else would be before Rosh Hashanah? Parshat Devarim always is read right before Tisha B'Av. Parshat Devarim, more than Parshat Shlach, has Chet HaMeraglim. The original Chet HaMeraglim is recorded in Parshat Shlach. But Devarim is when Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to the people before he dies, and he talks about Chet HaMeraglim, and he elaborates on it, and he takes part of the blame. He actually takes all of the blame. And right before Tisha B'Av, perfect. Because Tisha B'Av began with Chet HaMeraglim. Tisha B'Av is, yes, the morning of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, which is post-biblical, but the biblical part of Tisha B'Av is Chet HaMeraglim. And Chet HaMeraglim is read in Parshat Devarim, always the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, etc., etc. Now, I gave you the easy ones. There are more difficult somersaults that you have to turn in order to connect other things with their calendar associations, but it could be done. And any good American shul rabbi worth his salt can tie anything into Parshat HaShavua and Parshat HaShavua into anything. I was always amazed where the guy would say, I saw the New York Times yesterday, blah, blah, blah. And in this week's Sedra, there's a Rashi that speaks right to that point. And he would just go on and give a whole drasha based on the New York Times and Rashi from the Parsha.
You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Shabbat Parshat Pinchas. Today itself is Shivasar B'Tammuz, the beginning of the three-week period of mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and other things. And the guidelines that I personally try to stick to during the 3 weeks, as well as Sfirat HaOmer, is to stick to what's known as Shira Bapeh, vocal singing, without musical accompaniment. This kind of music is readily available in music shops now. This album specifically is called Shirei Bein HaMitzarim, Songs for the 3 Weeks. Avrami Flam presenting. It's produced by Noam Productions. And this is not only a cappella music, no musical accompaniment, just vocal, but it is also particularly the choice of songs on the whole album are appropriate for this period of time. What you heard at the very beginning of the show and at the beginning of this latest portion was the intro and the interlude, I guess you call it, between the words, the la-la-la part, of a song on this album called Hatichyena Hatzamot Ha'ela. Irrelevant what the song is, I just chose that as the musical intro for the show, at least during these 3 weeks. The creaky door and the come in welcome that preceded even the la 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 part, if you didn't catch it last week, I explained, comes from the old Radio Mystery Theater, CBS Radio Mystery Theater with E.G. Marshall, which I happen to be enjoying on MP3 lately. So I decided to use that as the intro to the intro. I have another piece of a mini shear that I gave to the folders yesterday. This was in response to a question about the restrictions of music. I tend to over-answer questions, and it contains stuff about hair cutting and other aspects of the 3 weeks. I would like to share that with the listeners, too, and then we'll finish up on Parshat Pinchas again, or at least continue.
The question was about the restriction of music during the 9 days, or the 3 weeks. Let's talk about it like this. The three-week period is that which spans Shivasar B'Tammuz to Tisha B'Av. There is no original mournful aspect to that whole period. The Mishnah mentions the events that occurred, which we commemorate on Shivasar B'Tammuz. Then it says, when Av enters, we diminish in joy. Then it speaks of things that are not to be done during the week in which Tisha B'Av falls, and speaks of the tragedies that are associated with Tisha B'Av. It was later, I don't know exactly when, I do know that it was already when there were Sfardim and Ashkenazim, because Ashkenazim stretched the mournful period from Shivasar B'Tammuz to Tisha B'Av, the period known as Bein HaMetzarim, where Sfaradim did not. Sfaradim fast on Shivasar B'Tammuz, and they get married on the next day. And they take haircuts on the next day. I saw in a sefer that an Ashkenazi barber is allowed to give haircuts during the beginning of the 3 weeks to Sfardim, but he's not allowed to give haircuts to Ashkenazim. How many actually do that, I don't know. A lot of barbers just close during the 3 weeks, but you are allowed to give it to a Sfardi, and a Sfardi is allowed to get married during this period, and an Ashkenazi is allowed to go to the wedding and have a good time. Because it's not, he yields his own minhagim to the Baal Simcha. But, even for Ashkenazim, I should say even, for Ashkenazim, where there is a mournful aspect to the 3 weeks, it intensifies during the 9 days, it intensifies further in the week in which Tisha B'Av falls, and you need to sort various and sundry activities into which pigeonhole they go. So if you say haircutting, then the Ashkenazi custom is the entire 3 weeks. If you say fingernail cutting, the Ashkenazi practice, as well as the Sephardi, is the week in which Tisha B'Av falls, only, Shavua Shechalvo. You want to cut your nails tomorrow, the day after, you could do that. Rosh Chodesh of Ashkenazim hold is already the 9 days, with all of its restrictions. Sephardim, who also have some restrictions that start at Rosh Chodesh, do it only right after Rosh Chodesh. For example, there's a cute thing brought down in today's Sfarim, that since you're not allowed to do laundry or wear freshly laundered clothes during the 9 days, Ashkenazi, Sfardim are allowed to do that on Rosh Chodesh, but not the day after. Not after that. But Ashkenazim can't already on Rosh Chodesh. So the recommendation for an Ashkenazi is, sometime before Rosh Chodesh begins, you put on a few different shirts and freshly laundered pants, suits, dresses, whatever, and then take them off, wear them for 15, 20 minutes or whatever, and then they're no longer freshly laundered. And then you could wear them during the 9 days. But let's say, says the book, an Ashkenazi yeshiva bucher, they use that example, forgot or didn't get around to wearing his shirts. Now he's got a restriction, any shirts that are freshly laundered, he can't wear during the 9 days. But on Rosh Chodesh Av, he could go to a Sephardi friend of his and say, could you do me a favor and put on these garments? And then he wears them 5-10 minutes, whatever, and then he gives them back, and you could wear them during the 9 days. I had a different situation when I was in Avelut, which also has that restriction of new garments. My problem was my daughter got married during that period, and I bought a new suit. So I asked Ashila about it before I bought it, and I was told I can't wear it. You know, here you could wear it before Rosh Chodesh so that you could wear it during the 9 days. But since I was in Avelut when I bought it, I couldn't wear it then either. Can't say wear it before the wedding, so then by the wedding it's not freshly, it's not a new garment. It's a new garment when you put it on. So I had to find someone else.
Your size?
Close to my size at least, I found. And I asked him to wear it, and the sock that I got was 5 minutes, 10, 15 is not enough. He has to wear it for most of the day, which he did, and then I took it to the dry cleaner, which I was allowed to, and I had a new, worn only once, recently dry cleaned suit for my daughter's wedding. But that's, you know, that's the way it works. Now, in long answer, we're getting, huh? We're not fooling anybody. No, we're not fooling anybody. You have to understand that these kinds of, whatever you want to call it, I don't want to call it a loophole, I don't want to call it a trick. I want to call it a thing, because I don't have a better word for it. A thing like this is meant to allow you to get around a technicality which is meant to have educational value, which it does because you're getting around it. In other words, if freshly laundered clothes is a symbol, not wearing freshly laundered clothes is a symbol of mourning, which during the 9 days we follow, then wearing them for 5 or 10 minutes before Rosh Chodesh and then wearing them during the 9 days still preserves the point. The point is, this is a period of mourning. So it's a perfectly respectable, acceptable way to not have to be in icky clothes. And that's why if you look at the halacha, it says that undergarments you could wear fresh. And if you need, you could wash them, but only in private. And, the outer garments wear, so they're not perfectly fresh. And what I do after I wear a whole bunch of shirts is toss them into a pile instead of putting them back on the hangers. So I feel as if they're really not fresh anymore, you know. Now you want to take that to an extreme, and you drag it along the floor in a dusty place.
Oh, yeah.
But you don't have to do that. Now let's get to the music.
The Sephardi tradition
doesn't include Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh, they're allowed to eat meat. Otherwise, it goes after Rosh Chodesh, but not during the first part of the 3 weeks. They don't have that.
Right.
Now, that creates a situation which allows for different levels of practice during the 3 weeks compared to the 9 days. Let me give you another one which I actually wrote about, which I saw yesterday. It was about shaving. Hair cutting, Ashkenazim don't do the entire 3 weeks. Shaving, there are two kinds of shaving. There is grooming a beard, which is like hair cutting. I am totally forbidden to trim my beard or even shave my cheeks to clean it out on my neck during the 3 weeks because it's like hair cutting. In modern times, a question has arose as to how we view shaving for a clean-shaven person. A clean-shaven person does that every single day, like washing his face. And it's arguable that it's really no longer in that same category of grooming and hair cutting for a clean-shaven person, man. So there are some that say, no, you know, when it comes to the 3 weeks, you can't shave at all. However, let's say a person is in a situation where his parnassa depends upon his presentable look. This is especially so outside of Israel. I argue that in Israel, it doesn't apply at all. In other words, a person should not be allowed to shave during the 3 weeks, no matter what his business is. When you see the mayor of Jerusalem, and I'm not talking about Lopoliansky, I'm talking about Olmert when he was mayor of Jerusalem, and one of his parents died, I don't remember who, and for 30 days he looked grungy. He did not shave, he wore kippah. Sfardim wear a kippah for 30 days, even if they're not kippah wearers, and they don't shave. And he conducted affairs of government and greeted foreign visitors and everything like that. So in Israel, I don't really see a heter. In Chutz La'aretz, where a salesman, an agent of some sort, a bank clerk, is expected to be properly groomed, so there's a heter, and they say, all right, but not during the 9 days. And even during the 9 days, if it still impinges on Parnassa, they say, okay, but not the week that Tisha B'Av falls. I have not seen any permission for the week in which Tisha B'Av falls for someone to shave. And that includes women. Women have a heter to, even though hair cutting is the same prohibition, when it is, let's say, the topic of shaving the legs, a married woman or a woman of marriageable age, and really you could extend that to anyone who claims presentability, can shave her legs during the 3 weeks, even during the 9 days, but not the week in which Tisha B'Av falls. A married woman who covers her hair and has strands that sneak out can trim those also. Pardon? Because the purpose of the ban on shaving was not meant to make you look ugly to your husband or to potential suitors. It was meant as a sign of mourning. And in general, there are many examples where this was not the intention. Let's take another example of purchasing new items, purchasing new clothes. You're not supposed to purchase new clothes during the 3 weeks. But let's say there's a sale. Then you're allowed to. Now that's weird if you think about it, because if you're not allowed to, then you're not allowed to. No. Because the halacha recognizes there's a difference between the joy that a person has in buying a new suit or a new dress and wearing it, or the very practical consideration of it's a good price, it'll cost you more, or even worse, won't be available after Tisha B'Av. And that's not what the halacha meant in the first place. So it comes up with an idea. Tell you what, it's on sale, it won't be available, buy it, put it away, and don't use it till after Tisha B'Av. So that's not a game that plays fast and loose with the halacha. That recognizes the way the halacha was constructed and what it was meant to accomplish. A mourner during the week of Shiva, and similarly during the 9 days, there are restrictions on bathing. If a person is a fastidious person, in Hebrew called, in Gemara language, an istinus, who I define as someone who does not shower and bathe every day, will get this psychological feeling that his skin is crawling with all kind of things, and he'll lose concentration and be a basket case because he didn't bathe every day. He is allowed to bathe during the 9 days, during the week Tisha B'Av falls on, during his Shiva of personal mourning, and who knows, probably on Tisha B'Av. I don't know, I'd have to look into that. Because the halacha was not meant to torture somebody. And if a person is tortured by that, then he has permission to be that rare exception.
Yesterday, when this was recorded, the memory of the MP3 ran out. The recording stopped. I kept talking. I don't remember for how long, but I will pick up the thread for you now. The concept of istinus, which I described, should not be taken as a blank check for anything. You don't say on Yom Kippur, if a person is depressed because he's fasting, then he doesn't have to fast. He does. Only life-threatening situations allow a person to eat on Yom Kippur. So don't generalize, but the fact of the matter is, when it comes to the laws of mourning, there is a general approach of leniency for certain circumstances. I had a fellow once who called me to ask if he could listen to music during the 3 weeks, because when it's too quiet in his house, he goes crazy. And in discussion with him about that, it seems like he is the type of person who actually suffers with a quiet environment, and he needs music to function properly. Of course he's allowed to listen to music. The restrictions were meant to remind people of Avelut HaChurban, mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. They were not meant to torture people. But any question that you have should be posed to your LOR, local Orthodox rabbi, if it doesn't fit well into anything that we've discussed till now. That's how it works. You really have a practical question. You should pose it as a rabbinic question, a she'ela, and not rely on something that was said in a different context, because it's not necessarily going to be applicable. Let me go off the record, so to speak, on a personal note, and I don't want to push anyone into behaving in a similar way, but I would like to tell you one of my thought processes as to how I treat the three-week period. Time for this week's Torah Tidbits audio is running out, especially because I want to finish with part of a track from Shirei Bein HaMitzarim that basically summarizes the upside. As much as a person mourns Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash, he should be longing and looking forward to its rebuilding. And there is that connection that is made. He who mourns the destruction will be privileged to rejoice in its rebuilding. That is echoed in the Ani Ma'amin number 12, in the coming of Mashiach, and the words of this song, the Afalpi.
Amen.
Personal mourning is supposed to be contained within reasonable limits, partially because of the belief in the world to come and in Tchiyat HaMetim. National mourning is to be held in containable limits because of the belief, the hope and prayer of the Geula. Things are rarely easy here, but in addition to the missiles that landed in Nahariya, 7 missiles landed in Tzfat a short time ago, killing one woman, injuring many others. We hope and pray for God's help, for the speedy recovery of the injured, for the well-being of all of the soldiers and all the people of Israel, and for the government here to do the proper thing, the right thing, to get us out of this situation. On that note, Shabbat Shalom, L'Geula Shlema, L'Hishtamech.